Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi at Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. We're putting this one out a little bit early for you. It's coming out Wednesday, July 3rd. This is a conversation that I had with Joe Mullings of the Mullings Group and Steve Bell, noted surgical robotics expert, at the Society of Robotic Surgery meeting, an annual meeting that took place last month in Orlando. And I hope you saw a bunch of my posts on LinkedIn about it. Obviously, Steve and Joe have been posting great thoughts about it as well. But we sat down that Saturday morning, which was day three of the conference, so day three of a four-day conference, and gave sort of a wrap-up of where we are as a surgical robotics industry, as a medical device industry. So I don't need to really give too many teases about this interview. Let's just say both Joe and Steve are huge fans of surgical robotics, know the area well, and are very honest with their opinions, and I appreciate that. So we wanted to get this one out to you before the 4th of July holiday, and we'll be off for the weekend. So I know you'll enjoy this conversation. Once again, I spoke with Steve Bell and Joe Mullings at the SRS meeting in Orlando. This one goes on for about an hour, but we cover a lot of ground. So I know you'll enjoy it. Before we get into this podcast episode, though, to continue the excitement around SRS, we'll have Steve Bell as our Device Talks Tuesday guest on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday. He will actually deliver the presentation that he used to open up SRS. He gave a great overview of surgical robotics and some interesting forecasts as to where it's headed. So you can register for that at devicetalks.com. It's free. Again, we'll have the presentation on Device Talks Tuesdays. You can watch it and ask questions. Steve will be able to take some questions from the audience. So if you haven't registered yet, please do. You can also, of course, watch it on demand. We won't be able to handle the questions on demand as we typically can with a Device Talks Tuesdays. But please join us at 4 p.m. on Tuesday, July 9th, and it'll be a great, great conversation. I'm really looking forward to it, and I hope you'll join us. Finally, of course, Device Talks West registration is open. Go to west.devicetalks.com to register. The agenda is filling out. It will be a fantastic couple of days. We will have surgical robotics companies there, of course, and in addition to interventional neurotech, women's health, we'll have structural heart, and much, much more. So go to west.devicetalks.com to register, or you can just go to devicetalks.com, and you'll find the Device Talks Tuesdays link, and you'll find the Device Talks West link. That, again, is happening, if I haven't already said it, October 16th and 17th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. All right, folks. Well, again, I'm recording this on July 3rd. We're putting this out on July 3rd. If you're listening to this on July 3rd, have a great holiday if you're in the U.S. Enjoy some time with your family and keep safe. And if you're listening to this at some other time, all of that still applies. Have a great time with your family and keep safe. That seems like a pretty safe statement to make. All right, let's get this podcast started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Hi, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. We're here at SRS's annual meeting. I'm happy to be joined by my two friends here. I'd like to say up front, I'm not responsible for 90% of what's about to be said here today. I love talking, so I'm here with Joe Mullings, of course, from the Mullings Group, and Steve Bell, surgical robotics expert. And you guys are like, you remind me of Red Sox fans prior to 2004. You love this field so much. And like, if someone doesn't run to first base, hedge, you're just up there like, come on, man! Whereas I'm like, go team! Like, nice effort, first base runner guy. So this is going to be a colorful conversation, I'm sure. So let's just kind of start from the top in terms of where surgical robotics is sort of, we're seeing layers in the industry. We're seeing different types of robots, stratification. Talk a bit about how that is shaping up. And Joe, you can kick it off. What sort of differences we're seeing and what sort of strata we're seeing in surgical robotics companies?
Yeah, you're right, Tom. And, you know, there's reason for that. So
pure economics and physics. The smart organizations have figured out not to go head-to-head with Intuitive. And so Intuitive created that category. Large format, hyper acuity, very high acuity surgery, cost per procedure, they've got it locked. I mean, they've really done a fabulous job year after year. Now, let's just put this aside. Medtronic and J&J are still trying to compete with them, which is silly. We'll get into that later. But the other organizations have said, look, you don't fight a kickboxer in a ring. You take him into a phone booth because his tools don't work there.
Yeah.
And so you're going to start to see this stratification of robotics, one for cost, two for clinical pathway through FDA, and then the investors' appetite for a $1 billion investment. Like Steve always points out, you better have dry powder for $1 billion, or pick a form factor that you can get into the game for $400-600 million.
Yep.
And you can get to market quicker. And then they're realizing that as these sites of care change, ASCs, outpatient, there's an opportunity there. That's that phone booth versus the ring, is let me go fight in the ASC now. Just a matter of time before Intuitive gets in there, but at least we're going to establish the stratification of those robotic platforms.
Okay. Steve, carry that on a bit and talk a bit about, I get your point about Medtronic and Johnson & Johnson going against Intuitive, and it seems like a foolish mission, but on the other hand, I don't know if they have a choice. Like, so talk, and it's almost, I don't, tragic is an overstatement, but I don't know what else they can do other than build their own robot. But Steve, talk a bit about that dynamic that Joe outlined with the larger robots in that market and what option those two companies have in terms of going against the 8,000-pound gorilla, or actually I think it's like 1,500 pounds,
yeah,
or whatever it was.
$150 billion market cap gorilla.
Yeah, it's big. So I think, again, you know, and Joe said it right, you know, it's a little bit crazy to go head against them. You know, and this week I put up some figures that some people may or may not agree with. I think they'll still have about 80% share in the US even 10 years from today.
Yep.
I think you raised the point that they've got no choice. They have no choice, because as open surgery and laparoscopy comes across to robotics, you know, that's just basically sucking the oxygen from their room.
Yep.
So they've got to go there. They've come at it too late, in my opinion. You know, and not from a technological point of view. A lot of it's just from a commercial point of view. They've let the base of Intuitive get too big. So now it's just like, it's like a super tanker that it's going to be very hard to stop. So I think that what they've got to do is, they've got to understand a couple of things. And the first thing is, and it's been said here, I think on every panel at SRS, robotics is really hard. I mean, really hard. And I don't care if you're J&J, you're Medtronic, or you're Stryker, or whoever. Robotics is hard. You know, Kevin Lobo said, even for the Mako, he said just how hard it was, and they had, you know, he had sleepless nights for 2 years. He said that in his talk. So understanding that, have a bit of humility, and understand that your one answer that you think you're going to go in with may not be the right answer, and stratify your strategy. You know, have something that might go against Intuitive, at least go and take some of that segment. But have some optionality. Think about what Joe said, you know, go to a different site of care, go to an OPD, go to a clinic, go to an ASC, fight them in the phone box. Mm-hmm. But go as companies and buy some chips in that optionality. And I think that my little bit of fear for them is that they've gone all in on one thing instead of saying, okay, this might not work, let's have a plan B at a certain price point and, you know, a certain amount of money to get there. And let's have a plan C, which is really down there closer to our core business of laparoscopy, where the price point is less, the training is less, the intensity is less, and they can do some learning from that, which is transferable. But just going in with just one big sledgehammer thinking you're going to take Intuitive, I think is a bit of a silly strategy.
Joe, let's talk about that context in the meeting. So J&J presented yesterday. Zero details in that presentation. That was just 10 minutes of a mission, which I guess they weren't here at the previous meeting last year. I think it was mentioned that they didn't, at least this time they were on stage. Tim Schmidt spoke and he reiterated robotics is hard. But he also acknowledged that, like, we need robotics to hold our position. So let's kind of close up on these larger systems. Where do you see us going from here? Make yourself CEO of J&J MedTech or deciding the strategy for Medtronic. Do you see an M&A happening? Where do we go from here?
Well, first of all, I'd be in human resources my first day there.
So. I give you a week before you're on the first show.
You're generous. So, given the data set we have right now, you could never let pride or ego dictate your strategy. And I think in both of those organizations right now, you've got that going on.
Okay.
So that's number one. But with that, there's two organizations that, other than Intuitive, are structured to support a worldwide launch of a good robotic platform. To simply aspirational want to be a robotic company doesn't work. You know, the culture and civilization in an Intuitive is almost palpable. Everything they look at is surgery that declares itself through a robot. Where Medtronic and J&J is surgery looking for a robot. Mm-hmm. And those cultures don't necessarily jump the chasm together. So with that, where I would start would be the following. Is I would be looking at where is my at least adjacent core competency in surgery. And in both Medtronic and J&J, it is the owner of the lap business. As much as it's eroding month after month to the robotics world, you have the ability to look at a moon, and you and I have talked about this a lot, and or a distal motion. Mm-hmm. And you need to have a couple horses in the race. Betting in surgical robotics, and we're seeing this here with 40 plus platforms, you've got to have a variety, even if it's soft tissue, because acuity, mid, high, and low acuity cases, lion's share is in that mid acuity case. And so what do you want there? The more volume, the more efficiency pays off. You don't need efficiency in a Da Vinci 5 as much as you need efficiency in a moon, mm-hmm. because your volumes are a lot higher, therefore efficiencies pay off. So I'll finish this up and then I want Steve's thoughts on this. Where I would go is I would look for the use of AI on the tip of my existing lap business, not way back in the mainframe. AI in the mainframe in medtech is not going to happen for a decade. AI is going to happen on forces at the tip of the instrument, on the tissue, and in the entry point, and that's going to allow me to really put actionable information into play. Let me get that moon platform. Let me get that distal platform. Personally, I think Medtronic is dead in the water for the next year or two on any massive acquisition. They have challenges, quality systems, challenges in integration. I think there's going to be a change at the top there in the next 12 months. It's indicative by all the leaders leaving right now. The choice has been made. I think it'll be announced in a few months. I've said that before. So I would be looking at an acquisition of a distal and or a moon in one of those. And then I would learn through that rather than trying to boil the ocean up against Intuitive.
Steve, let's take it from there. So Joe talked about Medtronic. Talk about J&J. I mean, they have Monarch, they have Velis, they have a couple of robots. But what would you suggest to them as a route? You have no shortage of opinions on Antava, and I'm referring to a LinkedIn discussion we had this morning. So where does J&J go from here?
Yeah, so it's difficult because they're in a bit of a pinch in my mind. That's one of the problems. And with Joe, they've got to stabilize at where their core strength is. And their core strength is in laparoscopy. They're brilliant laparoscopy. And they have some great product, and they have good contacts into that space. I think what they have to do is that they have to keep on with Ottava because they're half pregnant, right? They can't just give that up now, and they're almost there, almost there, almost there. We'll see if the IDE happens later this year. But I think they need to be working in that parallel strategy, as Joe says, back at where they are in the laparoscopy. And I think something like a moon surgical or a distal motion or even a CMR can be an entry point for them that gets them in early. So the moon surgical is really in their core competency of laparoscopy. And getting a stapler on the robot, and I'll talk a little bit about this, getting a stapler on the robot, advanced energy on the robot, is way harder than people think, mm-hmm. getting it to work well. So it allows them also, with a moon, you can use your handheld staplers that are class-leading, like an Echelon is a class-leading stapler. So they can use their class-leading products, start getting that combination surgery going, and it just makes more sense to them. But they're into the data game. They're into the servicing game. They're into the robotics game. They're into the understanding. And they can go and nip at, you know, like an ASC, which is where, you know, they can find business, and the business is going, by the way, and administrators would want it to go there. So they can go and fight in the phone box, exactly what you say, but in their core strengths and using all the things that they've got that are really strong for them as adjuncts to something like a moon. Whereas if they just keep going down the Ottava, they're going to come out with a next product that's maybe in one or two procedures. Mm-hmm. They may or may not launch with a stapler on it. They may or may not launch with an energy on it. And they're going against the Da Vinci 5, which has got every bell and whistle that you will ever want in every procedure. So I think they've got to have this kind of parallel path that keeps them in the game, keeps people interested to keep the laparoscopy, brings some of the laparoscopy away from some of the cheap staplers and the cheap advanced energies, and lets them not hemorrhage as much. It's probably a bad way for me to say it, but they don't hemorrhage as much, right, and as fast. And in the meantime, it gives them that time and that ability to get Ottava to where it needs to be, because it's going to take them, even if they did the ID this year, it's going to be 27, 28 launch, and then it's going to be 29 or 30 till you've got a fully competent system in all procedures. So you've got to do something in between to stem the flow of...
They need wins. And I mean, Steve, you've got to start getting wins on the board, as small as they are.
Yep.
And here's one other gap, I think, that J&J, when they came out with the polyphonic statement yesterday, which was interesting, I think that might have been in the works with the hope of eventually getting a robot. Here's a glaring gap in J&J's game. They have no, I can't even say best in class, they have no visual stack anywhere. And if you're going to move in and want to dominate the OR, you have got to, and Da Vinci 5 just threw down a gauntlet on that to even entrench themselves more. I'm surprised they did not come and step in front of Storz on the Ascensus buy and pick up Storz instead. I'm horrified that that didn't happen, because if you don't have a best-in-class visualization system, adding anything else, and to Steve's point, you take a Moon or a Distal, you pop on a Storz, now owned by J&J, right? A $3 billion run rate, I think, is what Storz has. I would have bought that before I bought Shockwave.
Yeah, no, I agree. And imaging is going to be one of the big battlegrounds in robotics. And one of the challenges for a company like a J&J or a Medtronic is that their brands are very good and the bar for themselves is high. So if I come out with a second-rate imaging system attached to my robot, I think people are just going to be really disappointed. It would be like, that's not J&J. Why isn't this world-class? Why isn't this the best of the best, which is what J&J really can do? So I think getting an imaging chain has been it was an essential miss. Unless they've got something in the works that we just don't know about that's really amazing.
Well, you got two best-in-class, Stryker and Storz, who spent decades establishing that. And that, to your point, That's an innate core competency, right? Those were born, at least Storz was born as an imaging company. It's hard to become an imaging company later in life, as hard as it is to become a robotic company later in life.
Let's talk, it's been an interesting contrast at this meeting. We're talking about how long these roads are for developing a surgical robotic system, but a lot of the buzz has been around Renovo, has been around the Mantra 3, all these companies that are just developing these comprehensive systems seemingly overnight, at least in surgical robotics years. Obviously, they're developing systems for outside the U.S., away from the FDA for now. But just talk about their success. How have they been able to do what they've done? And I don't know where it goes from here. I mean, they're probably acquisition targets, I would think. But talk a bit about the success of Renovo and Mantra. I know it's and SSI.
Yeah.
SS Innovations.
Yeah. So, again, part of the benefit you get of hindsight is you stand on the shoulders of giants, okay? So you see a lot of the things and you understand a lot of the learnings. I mean, we only had one robot out there for 20 years, so that was the paradigm that it was in. But then, you've got CMR out there and you've had Hugo out there, and you can learn a lot just standing in the OR and watching any of those systems. And if you're a good set of engineers, you can work out pretty quick, that length isn't quite long enough, that joint isn't quite, got the angle. So you can stand on the shoulders of giants and that can be fast. So that's one part of it. But the other part of it is cultural, both in India and China, they are rapid people, and that's all they focus on. They wake up in the morning at SSI and they go Mantra. At lunch, they're talking Mantra. At dinner, they're talking Mantra. And just before you go to bed, you're dreaming about Mantra, right? That makes an intense difference than a company that sat there waking up and saying, well, how's our profitability on our sutures this morning? And what about hemostats? And you get where I'm going.
Yeah.
So I think that ultra focus also helps. And you start combining that all together. And the third piece of it is, they're not constrained by the fear of failure. Okay? If they fail, they go back to zero, right? You start at zero, you go up, and you've got everything to win for. The problem is that when you're in these other companies is you've got brand, and of course I understand, you know, you don't want to screw up your brand of a multi-billion dollar business. You don't want to do that. But that cage that's around you changes every dynamic of thinking. People don't get fired for saying no, right? It's rare to get fired for saying no.
Yeah.
But you get fired for making a ballsy decision and going on with it and going for it. And if it doesn't work out, then you're fired. So cultural is a huge piece of this within the companies. I don't know what you think, Joe.
Joe, it's a familiar dynamic. I mean, these are startups. I mean, this is something that's been happening in medical devices for decades. The startups eat, drink, and sleep, whatever they do. Mako built Mako. Stryker went in and bought it. Hard tissue, I know. Why? I'm curious as to why, you know, Medtronic and J&J haven't looked externally and why everything is so internally focused, because you typically would have allowed a smaller company to do what Steve just described.
First of all, Steve touched on something, and I'm going to answer
go
that.
Ahead.
So he talked about the ability to have a less than optimal outcome. We can call it failure, but it's not, because you don't necessarily go back to zero. You go back to more experience.
Yes.
Right? So that's really important to understand. In the U.S., in the large corporations, talent-wise, people are managing careers, not developing technology. It's very clear. Once you hit past a certain, about a 5 to 7 year threshold, and you're in a fast track, whatever that fast track definition is for you, in mid to large corporations, you were spending as much time managing a career, maybe even more, so as not to have a blemish on your record. Mm-hmm. And you compound that over thousands of employees, and then having the ability, this is what I love about the Israelis. The Israelis, at any rank in their within the military, can talk to the commanding officer and say, no, wrong, and it's acceptable. And there's a reason why you can accelerate technology so quickly there. So that's that. Going back to your question, why the challenge? I don't think that Medtronic and J&J, if what they know today, they knew 15 years ago in both camps, they would try to internally develop a surgical robotic platform. I don't think anybody can fathom how complex it is. It just, right. It wasn't possible, right? Because you're a lot more of what you don't know back then than what you do know. Now, acquisitions, you asked. There's some great platforms out there. You will not see a Chinese robot get plugged into the wall in the United States. So you can just take that right off the table.
Why is that?
Well, geopolitical reasons, security reasons, the TikTok factor. Mm-hmm. We already have internal issues with employee health, patient health records within our own borders. Now you think that's going to stand up under rigor, plugging a Chinese robot into a wall in the United States? Hmm. I mean, it might not be a popular thing for me to say amongst our friends from the APAC region, but it's just, in the climate we're in today, not going to happen. I don't think it needs to happen. There are so many great robots out there in EU, in the UK, here in the US. I don't think we have to go to APAC region to find a good robot. Mm-hmm. And I think, to Steve's point also, in those regions, good enough is good enough. Mm-hmm. And I don't think J&J or Medtronic are going to buy a robot to compete with Intuitive that's good enough.
Yeah. Let's move down around and talk about the Moon Surgicals, about the Levita. We saw the Mars robot last night. How does this shape up with Distal Motion and the others? They're all commercially ready, they're all selling, or they've got FDA approval. Distal, not yet. But what do you see happening over the next year as to how these companies move into the market? And let's talk at the end of this conversation about M&A again. Are they likely going to remain self-standing companies for a very long time? Steve, how do you see this sort of playing out?
Well, I can give advice on this, having been there. So I think they've got to be smart about how they do their go-to-market. What they can't do is just burn through all their money and try and go everywhere and do everything for everybody at once. I think what they've got to do is prove out their thesis. And you know, if your thesis is we can do hernias in an ASC, go and focus in and prove that. You know, don't be spreading yourself too thin. Definitely geographically, they don't need to be in everywhere. You don't need to prove you can do hernias in San Diego and Boston and Texas and Florida. You don't need to do that, right? What you need to do is show out your thesis that it works. Because all these companies, are either going to get bought or they're going to die. And I hate to say that, but this is so capital intensive. You can't keep raising the money forever. You just can't do it. So they need to prove out and make themselves very attractive and help the strategics to understand why they're the right fit for them. That's what I would be recommending that they do, rather than going out and trying to, you know, hit some numbers and say, hey, we've got 100 systems out there, and we, you know, and you've got engineers running everywhere, and you've got 100 clinical implementation, and you're just crushing under your own weight. Better to go out there and say, we've got 10 systems, and we prove that this is the absolute bullseye in this segment, and if a big guy got hold of us on this, this would just be a huge standalone business on its own.
Joe, focus on Moon Surgical a bit, in particular, and you can go broader if you want, but they had the Moon Truck here. I got to see a demonstration of Maestro yesterday. I'll put a video up on LinkedIn, or I probably already have at this point. How does a company like that move forward?
Well, Steve nailed it. You know, you got a really interesting case study with CMR. So CMR had a trajectory unlike any other surgical robotic company ever, even over Intuitive, on their ability to raise money, ability to, you know, 18,000 cases, maybe more, I don't know.
23,000.
23,000, 14,000 the registry, right? Like, just nailed it. But you ask any of the leadership, we overhired, we scaled too fast, we took on the load of a commercial team, and we didn't have a very controlled market launch, right? That, you burn through an enormous amount of money, but it's easy to get caught up in that inertia and that entropy. It's almost drug-induced.
Yeah.
So what I want to see a Moon and a Distal on both of those. To Steve's point, let's start slow. There's no reason. What you have to do is pick 6-8 centers of excellence. Highly likely, even though you're going into an ASC model, the institutional teaching hospitals where the KOLs play. If you're not in VIP's hands or Santi's hands or some of the others, you may not exist. And I don't mean that in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to have them say, that is good for this. This is good for this. It doesn't have to be an Intuitive. So that's one. Two is, it's going to be a challenge, because there's never been a time for using those two companies in particular to get acquired. It's very clear, Hugo has been a disappointment. Otava, at best, 2030, he's going 2028, I'm going 2030 in that form factor. But here's where it gets messy. We don't know the dynamics in an ASC. We can't figure out the pricing right now and price per click, surgery as a service, price per case. That's not been structured before in this environment. We've got to put in place a system where ASCs, while they're the high growth, they're struggling for staff to bring in surgeons.
Mm-hmm.
Most surgeons are employees today. They're not entrepreneurs anymore. So you've got a little bit of a dynamic environment going on in that sort of area commerce you're trying to sell into, and they're both trying to figure it out. Moon has a challenge because they don't have a reusable revenue stream, so they've got to look at a profit center somewhere else. Distal's got to come in and figure out what does their revenue stream look like into these sort of dynamic models.
Mm-hmm.
So I think slow and steady, be standing there. There's not another form factor coming out in the next 24, 36 months that's going to compete with them. You've got CMR, who's in FDA now. You've got Moon, and you've got Distal. Those three right now are on the table. They're better off playing it slow and not get the dry powder burnt out, because then they're in a bad spot, like we've seen some other companies in other categories get pulled.
Let's talk about finances and financial and how these companies will be paid for their services. There was a comment on a panel yesterday, I forget who it was, but someone, they had knowledge of Brazil, and they were told, Intuitive has told folks in Brazil, like, whoever comes in will match their price. Like, they're going to use their financial might. So they have the ability to turn dials as well and really change the game to all the adding uncertainty to everything you've just described. What does financing solutions look like for these companies? You said we're still up in the air with robotics as a service, but let's explore that a bit more. And where do we end up in a year or two? How are these robots and their services paid for?
Well, let's go back a little further with that question. It's really, that challenge is going to be a quandary all the way up to how the venture capitalist is going to think about financing a company.
Yep.
Because classically, it was sales, not placement of a robot. And somebody's got to finance that robot in a placement when it's on a lease. So that changes the dynamics tremendously on the venture money coming in, on the balance sheet. So that's those dynamics are going to change a lot. And right now, what's interesting is midstream, both Moon and Distal, their original thesis was selling a system, not placing a system. So moving forward, that dynamic is going to affect venture money coming in.
Interesting.
Okay. Then now, if you're selling into an ASC, you're now selling to a different customer base. Now, it's a lot more agile, which could be fun, but you're either selling to a private equity firm who are way more savvy than an institutionalized financial group in a hospital. You're selling to a surgeon, a surgeon-owned facility or partnerships. And now you're selling something that has a shared risk with it, which if you're going to be in a shared risk relationship, that means you have to deploy more resources to make sure that relationship stays platinum.
Interesting.
Which introduces new financial dynamics to it.
Steve, add to that. I mean, we talk about technology challenges, but the services challenges, I think, are almost as big.
Yeah, I think, and I've said it before, I think the technology challenges are like 10% of this.
Yeah.
I think the rest of it is the commercial challenges, you know, the service and all that kind of stuff. I think, again, if you look at, and we'll talk again about, say, an Ottava and a Hugo, part of the problem with this is you have to say, we are just going to end up having to place these robots, right? So the cost of the capital you're placing becomes really important, because the number of cases probably doesn't change. If I do 200 cases with, let's say, a Moon, okay? Or I do 200 cases with a Hugo, okay? And I can, you know, different models. But how many cases do I have to do before I pay my capital back? So the smart companies are going to be the ones that when they place it, that within an arc of, say, 9 months or 12 months, they've paid back the capital. So they're not floating that cash out there for long. It's not just about the amount of cash, it's how long the cash floats out there. Because the problem with this, and I've lived it, you place one, you think, okay, the clock's ticking on the cash. And you get 3 months in, and you say, okay, now we place another. And now you've got the clock ticking again. And if these things are taking 3 years to break even, you basically kill yourself by placing more systems. The more systems you place, the more you hemorrhage.
Yeah.
And this doesn't get thought about enough, but the investors have got wise to it, and I've talked with many investors lately about this. They are concerned about this, about just how much cash has to go out the door before you get the revenue streams back in. Because if you've got a robot and it costs you, let's call it 300,000, and the day that you place it, you get 1 million in the bank, that's okay, right? And that allows you the time to go up and you've made the cash back. If I've got 300,000 that goes out, and I'm only making back 25 grand a quarter in consumables because my model's like that. I mean, that's a long time before you get to break even. And the cost of capital at the minute, you know, it's just very, very expensive. And every time that you put a system in and you don't get the cash back, you're starving the rest of your company. You're starving R&D, you're starving the commercial, you're starving the marketing, you're starving different areas of it to pay for basically being, you're basically becoming a bank. So that's what all these companies have to work out. And the J&Js and the Medtronics need to work out as well. Because I don't care how much money you've got on your balance sheet, right? On a quarterly meeting, when you're sat there and you've placed 50 robots and you've hemorrhaged that cash and you're not going to see anything coming back in, when you look across your surgical business, it's going to look horrendous. So I think this is a big challenge for everyone. And Intuitive have got that install base. They're the ones who milked the cow early on. They got all the money in and got the benefit of it and put it into their war chest. No one else is going to repeat that ever again in history. And their install base is throwing off cash like you wouldn't believe, that's just fueling. So it's becoming a circle for them. Everyone else starts from zero. So it's a problem, it's a massive challenge.
And I think, I don't know if it was your talk, which was fabulous, and Dave Rosa was just after you. I'll hopefully get this correct. I think the consumable revenue is 85% of Intuitive's cash flow. And so, like, that is a really scary number to go up against. And I believe Intuitive just keeps on, in that environment, pulling the big players into the deeper end of the pool, until finally one of the leaders in the two organizations say, we need to spin off our entire robotics division to a separate entity. Because we want to protect, just like Google did, right? So they pulled it off, and they put Verily off on the side, so it didn't affect their share price. Yeah. And now you could start to have intellectual conversations and behaviors not driven by quarterly share price, which drives behaviors. Because if you're going to be in robotics, you can't answer the quarter-to-quarter bell in the development process, right? Just ask Vicarious about that and others, right? Because then you start pulling your punches.
It's a long game. It's not a quarter-to-quarter game.
That's right.
Intuitive feels to me like Apple creating that whole infrastructure that I'm immersed in and I can't move from. We were buying a new phone and I looked at the Samsung phones and they're awesome. They're like, that's really cool. But I'm an Apple guy and I'm going to stay there. And it's a big hurdle to overcome.
And on that, what they've been smart. They've not just created a moat of, you know, a commercial moat that's difficult in itself.
Yeah.
They've got a technological moat because theirs is the best system out there, the Da Vinci 5. They've got a procedure moat. They're in the most procedures. They've got an end effector moat. They're in that. They've got the data moat, the ecosystem moat, the training moat, the proctoring moat. They've just got everything tied up. And each one of those little barriers, it's like death by a thousand paper cuts for anyone who's trying to go against them. And they've been smart with it. They've just been really, really clever the way that they've done this.
Let's talk about some of the other specialties that have been talked about here today or over the last couple of days. Talked about robotics and plastic surgery. We've already talked about dental before. Neurovascular is a space that I'm excited about. How do we see the expansion of robotics into those specialties happening? If this were a typical medical device sector, I think you could see it and how it would unfold. But given all the complexities we just talked about robotics, all that's going to carry on into every specialty that we mentioned. But let's tackle neurovascular first, and I'll let either of you take it. What do you think happens in that space? There are probably five or six interesting companies that presented yesterday on stage.
So Steve and I have chatted about this. That neurovascular, endovascular space is just wide open sort of playground for everybody right now. One is the complexity of developing an endovascular robot is still challenging, but nothing near a forearm soft tissue robot. Additionally, you've got easily close to a dozen acquirers.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you've got more venture capitalists who want to come in with money. You've got already, I think people are going to learn. It was funny, I had past president sitting with me the other day of Olympus, and he said, when we were thinking about getting into robotics, the concern was it was going to cannibalize our business. And I said, well, you better off being the one that cannibalizes your own business rather than somebody else, right? And so, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of lessons learned as, you know, endovascular, neurovascular companies, structural heart companies watch from the sidelines and go, wait a minute, remember what happened to the lap business, minimally invasive business with Medtronic and J&J. You know, they should have gotten in a lot earlier. So I think we're going to see a fabulous environment over the next 5, 6, 7 years, everything from structural heart to neuro on stroke to remote. I wasn't a big fan of sort of remote robotics. I'm a huge supporter of it now for a number of reasons. Yes. We won't go in now, but I didn't look deep enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can bring a robot like that to market within 12 to 18 months, especially as the first couple, there's a couple right now, two coming in from Europe, one in the US happening right now on the structural heart side. So once that dam is broken, the FDA was here, there's tailwinds on robotics from the FDA, which is helpful. I think that overshadows soft tissue robotic platforms.
I completely agree. And again, you have to look at driving motivators. One of the stats that came out in one of the talks was that there was 6,000 sensors that can do, that can actually do the neurovascular, but only 600 of them can actually do stroke therapy, the thrombectomy. That in itself automatically tells you, and I'm bigger on the distance or tele-robotics that are going to do this, because you've got a difference in stroke that you don't have when you're so much when you're going for a colon or something like that. And that's really that time is brain, number one.
Mm-hmm.
This hub and spoke that one of the speakers eloquently talked about, and if you can deploy the robots out there into the communities where they get them, the cost saving to society of doing that is in, he was talking the billions. I think he was saying ridiculous. It was a crazy, it was like a percentage of GDP of most countries. So one of the problems with robotics today is if you're taking a lap coley and you do a robotic coley with it, you're not really changing the game, you're not changing the dynamics, and the cost model of it is not that critically the saving. You get somebody who within 2 hours gets a stroke treatment by a robot out there, and you save, you know, $1 million on life cost. That is game changing. So that's why I think there's a huge motivator, plus reimbursement's favorable. It's just a lot of things that are really in its favor that today in surgical robotics is not quite there.
Mm-hmm. One other item too, so there's I was chatting with Maggie Nixon, who's got Carmat, that's doing a interventional structural heart valve.
Absolutely.
Brilliant platform. She's fabulous, love her, huge fan. She's doing a mitral valve repair technology. So she's developed a new valve, and she's obviously developed the delivery mechanism on a robot. What you also have to think about, Tom, which is, you know, one of the reasons I like something like Moon, is the construct of implants have been driven by the ability of the delivery mechanism, not necessarily by the anatomical opportunities within the patient. So with a surgical robotic interventional robotic platform, you can change the construct of the valve because you don't need a specific type of catheter to deliver it nor navigate it, but you can do it via a robot. So I think interventional endovascular, neurovascular robotics is also for the big players like the BSCs and the Strikers and some of the others, is going to be an unlock for other products that, if not but for a interventional endovascular robot, you would never be able to deploy. So I think we have a gold rush coming because of the enabling factor of endovascular robots.
A gold rush from VCs?
A gold across the board, but you have a gold rush inside BSC, inside, you know, maybe even a Gore, inside these companies, like, wait a second, we've had to deliver this a certain way because of the limiting factor of either interventionalists or only a skilled surgeon. If you think about structural heart, mitral is only 2.4% of the overall population of those who need a mitral valve put in. And some of that is just skill, and some of that is the ability to deliver, some of that is valve size or construct. You can start to change all that. So BSC starts to now have a brand new portfolio of products because of the delivery mechanism introduced by an endovascular robot.
So talk a bit about the sort of the leveling of the playing field and the skill that surgical robotics can bring. You mentioned neurovascular. I mean, I'm excited by that as well, because surgical robotics could help someone who isn't able to remove a clot be able to remove a clot if they have the guide wires and the AI to help them get there safely. Structural heart, implanting valve. I mean, are we getting to a point where the robotic systems are going to be augmenting ability as opposed to making them more efficient?
Right, so I'm going to give you a sort of left field example of this that I'm involved with myself, which is Lupin Dental. Mm-hmm. Okay, so dental aesthetics, completely untapped market, huge, self-pay, patient pay. Why don't more people get veneers today? Because the skill required by the user is so high to get the facets of the teeth done properly, it's more or less impossible for most. So dentists, they've got an untapped market that they can't actually make into a profit center because they can't do it. You bring in something like a Lupin Dental, which is it's automated the prep of the tooth. And it actually mimics the two best people in the world, which is Stephen Coubet and Galip Gurel. They basically digitized them into the platform, which is amazing.
It is amazing.
So now what you've done is you've enabled every dentist in the world, no matter what their skill level is, they can do the prep like the two best people in the world tomorrow, okay? And that just changes the game. And the reason why that sort of robot is an enabler is because today they wouldn't do the case, so the $10,000 out of the pocket goes away. Instead, tomorrow they can do it, they take $10,000, you know, Lupin takes a cut of that, and everybody's happy because it's an enabler. And more robots are going to not just level the playing field, they're going to open up markets because now people have the things that you can't do by hand that are able to be done because of the enabling factor of the robot.
And in the elective surgery world, Steve's right, it also bring pricing down, which will bring more patients or consumers into that category. what robotics does too is accelerates the path to competency. And I think that's really important as we mint less and less surgeons and interventionalists.
Yep.
So we're going to start to introduce a level of competency at a much higher rate than we ever had before. That's one. And two is, you know, you look at something like Procept, right? Procept allows those procedures now to be done by urologists that never could have been done before because they did one ticket, and to split those uprights without losing performance on the patient was not something that was willing to be a risk by the patient and or the surgeon. So I think that robotics, as we continue to grow, does bring down procedural prices, especially on elective surgeries,
yep.
Or self-pay, and then increases that rate of competency for surgeons.
See, this is the exciting stuff, the stuff to get you. We opened up the conversation with all the downside. We got that out of the way. This is the stuff to get you excited. So, Joe, I know you're plugged into the VC world, the investor world. We talked a bit about financing before. As we were talking about all that's gone wrong, I'm like, no one's ever going to invest in this sector again. I hear you both talk about what robotics can do, and I'm like, well, here's the opportunity. So what are you hearing from VCs in terms of investments in new startups? And if you were talking to someone, I know you do, who's either starting a company or needs to raise a Series B or C, what kind of advice or forecast or outlook are you giving them?
Well, look, venture is looking for money in and an exit.
Yeah.
So, you know, that becomes tough based on the playing field that you plan on developing a system in. And we're watching, you know, some precarious times going on right now on people who are sort of IDE. So I think you're going to see a lot of fall-offs. I think there's a number of IDEs being filed right now. We're waiting for data to come out after that IDE is filed. And I think you're going to see a lot of rapid deaths in this category, candidly, right now, because there's not going to be enough compelling data to say, let's now put $400 million into commercialization. Mm. That's going to be a really hard bridge to gap. What I do like is companies like Revival Healthcare with Rick Anderson and Todd Pope, where they're coming a little more with a PEVC sort of build-to-buy model. And I believe over the next 3 to 5 years, Sensibility is going to come into the Strikers, the J&Js, the Medtronics, Becton Dickinson, dare I say, maybe even an Endovascular with Mike up at BSC, to say, let's partner. Let's share risk on clinical. Let's share risk on commercial, because those are your two big spends
yep.
when you're building a robot. I don't then have to get 4 or 5x return on that dollar, so I don't have to put in another $500 million. I can pull in your quality systems, I can pull in all that, stay there, build it outside of our bureaucratic milieu,
mm-hmm.
and then let's share in the revenue as we take this to market. I hope that's where the market goes.
Yeah.
I believe that's where the market's going to go. It's going to take one or two wins for that to quickly accelerate, because the finance community are a number of lemmings, and so are the large strategics. See one, do one.
Yep.
So I think that's our path forward in that area of finance.
And Steve, I'm sure you're getting a lot of due diligence calls from investors, folks who want the inside look at startups. What are you hearing and seeing and your feelings about the future?
Yeah, so it's interesting. They're kind of a little bit like Goldilocks at the minute. They're looking for that sort of perfect thing. So if you talk about investing into soft tissue surgical robotics, 34 systems out there, more growing, more coming from China, there's just no feeling of appetite to go into there because it's a crowded space. But then you go into some of the other emerging areas, and I think there's some really exciting areas. Histosonics has been awesome. Mm. I think that's one of the awesome things that's here. But you talk about going to those areas, and it's slightly off where they're used to knowing about, and they go, oh, it's too risky. So they're kind of looking for that Goldilocks zone in the middle, so I feel, at the minute.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what will happen is some will go into some of the other spaces. There's going to be some guided combination robotic therapies. So some of the guidance systems like Quantum and... There's a lot of them coming, which are going to be these small guided systems that are going to change therapies a lot. You know, you're going to not go and have to do a major cancer removal because you'll have nubbed it before it became major cancer. There'll be a lot more see and treat robots coming. And Ion and Monic can do a lot in here on the lung cancer side of things. I think the investors are going to find areas where they're a little bit maybe they're not educated on it so much at the minute, but one will go in there and then the sheep effect will happen, I do think. I don't think people are going to be ploughing money into the soft surgical, but I think there's other robotic areas, the neurovascular, the endovascular, the structural heart.
Ophthalmology. Don't sleep on ophthalmology.
Yep. Ophthalmology.
Good one.
You know, and MMI, you know, like the micro. I mean, you know, MMI is, it's here at this meeting, and, you know, they're not going head-to-head with Intuitive. It's still in the soft tissue, but in a different way. And I think as investors see that there's excitement in these areas, I think the investment will come into it.
Let's talk a bit about, we referenced the Sensus Stores deal earlier, but help me understand the significance of that. I mean, just the fact that there was an acquisition of a surgical robotics company by a larger player, I think is intriguing, but you've educated me on the power of the tower and all that's gone in, and I'd love to just kind of get a sense of what you see as possibly the next shoe with all... No, first, I guess, what does that deal do for the market today? And then let's talk about the next shoe that may fall if someone else needs a tower and needs to compete. So, Joe, talk about the significance of the deal first.
I think the significance of the deal continues to compound
okay.
in value and reality. I hope for the good of the category that those who are upset at the deal for $100 billion get over it. And if that ends up blocking the way, then there's going to be a bunch of lawsuits against the casinos in Vegas.
Yeah.
I think that was your line, right? Like, oh, wait a minute, I went there and I gambled.
And I lost.
Well, welcome to Wall Street, baby. So, look, I think Anthony Fernando, it's no secret, I've been a fan and advocate of his. I think Anthony was ahead of his time. He was one of the earlier players who said, it's not about the robot, stupid. It's about all the data around it. The ISU is a jewel in the a census world. We'll see where Luna comes in. I mean, using Steve's line, stood on the shoulders of Senhance, learned our latest lessons, what not to do, what to do. Now you plug in best-in-class, besides Stryker, visualization system. I think this forces the hand of, you know, I think Luna's great. I don't even know if they'll bring Luna to market. Just my, you know, because Storch can't pull themselves into the robotic business. Mm-hmm. That will be the kiss of death. They can pull themselves into owning the interventional or the OR suite with the ISU, with their visualization system, and probably some other things they have on the drawing board, like Stryker's trying to do in that area. And that's why the polyphonic thing by J&J is interesting, with no visualization platform, right, and no robot. So I think it hits, I think it closes by September, October. I think you get to see the organization state what they're going to do. I don't think they're going to swing for the fences, but I think they're going to push the ISU and the Storz visualization platform forward. Luna will take its time getting developed. And then, you know, this is a little crazy, but maybe at that point in time, the Storz family is getting older. You took a $3 billion a year company and maybe increased its value to $15 billion now with the mix of those two. And maybe J&J plays a card on that in order to get best-in-class visualization, a cleared robot, and something to plug into their polyphonic claim.
Yeah, no, I
agree. So the tower companies, we said earlier, they have to do something, right? Because the encroachment onto their business. We talk about the tower, but we also talk about the smart ORs. I mean, basically, you know, I sat on the DV5 yesterday, and I had my head in a smart OR, period. Okay, I wouldn't need to go and build a smart OR around me. That's just in that there, in a beautiful clickable menu within the DV5. So, Storz has been at least they're ahead thinking about and saying, we have to do something. Now, what they're going to finally do with Luna or Senhance, whatever, I think that's going to come out in the wash in the next 12 months. They'll digest it and understand it. I think Luna is a step ahead. I think they learned from Senhance, and you know, they fell a lot of times. They understood that straight instruments are not accepted. Mm-hmm. They understood that the laparoscopic paradigm of movements is not accepted. And given full credit, they learned from it, and they've adapted. And if they come out with the first 5 mil fully wristed, by the way, that's pretty sweet for Storz. I do like your thing. I think the story of J&J buying Storz, I think, was back even when I was there back in like 1996 or something like this. I seem to sort of always remember someone say, hey, I think J&J's going to buy Storz. So their gap is their vision system, as you say. But there's another big gap that J&J has that they're walking into right now, which is capital sales. They're not used to the capital sales process. Giving away an ultrasonic scalpel machine is not a capital sell. You know, giving away a Velys that's attached to your implants is not a capital sale. The capital sales process can't be underestimated. I'm a pretty cocky guy, and I thought I was great until I went in and I did, you know, CMR, and I got slammed in the head and thought, this is really, really hard. Oh my God, the number of call points that you got to go to, and the number of people, and I've got to convince people for a 7-year program switch, and this budget's in here, and this budget's in it, and you know, eking out, you know, a budget had taken 18 months. If you bought Storz, you buy tribal knowledge. That's one of the things you do buy as well in there.
And you have your foot in the camp.
Yes.
Which J&J does not have now. So you're inside the ropes now if you pick up a Storz.
Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the highlights and surprises of the meeting. I'll just throw up, not a surprise, but I think it's a highlight because it generated a lot of excitement, was the FDA appearing here, and you referenced that in LinkedIn. I didn't get to attend the session. I'm doubting there was a lot of breakthroughs, but I think just having them here was important. What was your assessment? I don't know if you sat in the session, but what is a greater meaning of having the FDA attend a meeting like this one?
I sat in on the session, and it would be like sitting in on a public company statement. There's only so much they can say to the outside.
Yeah.
Right. So you weren't expecting any groundbreaking drop there. I think Jeff Shuren would have been on the next plane down and rectified that right away. But the fact that they showed up at this event, at such a event, like other events have been around for 20, 30 years, have not had the FDA show up. That to me signals that the FDA is very supportive of the surgical robotic world. And it also shows you the influence that VIP and others have in the FDA. And I'm not saying that they've got an advantageous sort of lead, but they represent where the industry's going, surgical, interventional procedures are going. And the FDA knows that. The FDA is here to learn and also to give some insight and signal that we're open for business and we want to help you.
I think it was one of my favorite sessions. And I actually, I've been on Q-Subs in the past with Benita, and she was great. I thought they were open, honest, genuine. Again, they can't go too far and say things, but there were some big insights that I got from it. And the biggest one for me was basically that they're going to classify some robotic-assisted surgery systems devices as a class.
Hmm.
And give a 510K. Right. That is massive. So if you look, smell, taste like a Da Vinci, and you've got it close enough and you can convince them you're close enough as a clone of Da Vinci, you get a 510K. I heard that clear. That's massive. And that's, you know, they've been 510K originally, then they went de novo. If they open that pathway.
So pure 510K, not de novo.
Pure 510K, that's what I heard. And again, maybe I got
it wrong. The safety profiles will be incredibly severe, obviously. But if you can prove that, and then Fred Mole brought up something interesting where Fred always is always banging on that door in regards to bench strength. Bench testing should be the table stakes and standard of is a robot past the safety. Right, not the procedure side of how it's used.
Yes.
And I thought that was interesting. Fred's been pushing that for a couple of years. And I didn't say the FDA say, yeah, you're right. But I did see them look at each other. And so I do see it going that way as well. So.
I love the reading of the body language. And I have this vision of Jeff Shuren coming down with the Men in Black eyes with the stare of my pen. We're going to wipe your minds clean of what was just said 10 minutes ago. That was one, I think, illuminating, surprising outcome. What was something about the meeting that you didn't expect to see or hear that is sticking with you?
It was more of what didn't happen. So Medtronic was non-existent here in regards to a robot.
Yeah, I was surprised. I was surprised with no Ugo.
Right? So that,
You can have, if something that's CE marked, you can have it here and just say it's not FDA approved. There's no reason.
Lots of problems.
No reason not to,
Right, but so that that to me was really interesting. You can tell me all, you can talk to me all day about what you're going to do, but I'm going to watch what you do.
Yeah.
And they've struggled. They've struggled mightily on that platform. And, you know, internal conversations that I understand that go on, it's almost as they get in their quarterly review of programs and platforms, they can't get through a review of the Hugo quick enough. So the fact that Medtronic basically was non-existent here was I didn't realize it till late last night when, you know, I listened to Schmidt's thing and then said, okay, what? Wait a minute, there's nobody from Medtronic here. That to me signaled something.
Yeah, I mean, Rajit Kamal did present yesterday after J&J. So, but there was no robot here for sure.
No robot.
I know you like to see a robot, Steve.
You got little players coming from Barcelona.
Yeah,
they
no.
did a Rob Surgical did a procedure.
I'm going to talk to him
over at Nicholson the night before, and then marched their robot across the street and put it up over here.
Yeah. Yep.
If you're going to be in the game and play with the big girls and big boys, you better have your robot here.
Yep. So. Steve, how about you?
So there was a couple of things. So first of all, the competency around the Chinese robots has been a really pleasant surprise.
Yep.
and some of that. And Renova, I'm really hot on Renova. I think that's...
Agreed. John Ma has done a nice job.
Yeah, and John's a smart guy. The team's a great team. But what they've done is they've basically built what Hugo should have been in my book. And I keep saying this, but I think that's what Hugo should have been. But there was also some others like Kang Duo, right? So Kang Duo showed a 3-console, 5-arm surgery. You know, that's, you know, really impressive. Telesurgery over distance. Telesurgery, I've been kind of against that, poo-poo against it. I'm thinking a little bit about it coming out of this meeting. And the reason for that is, it's never, for me, been about the technological ability, but it's about the regulatory and the infrastructure and who pays and operating rights. You know, you can't even do it, you know, within a small distance. But VIP gave me some hope that they are really trying to work out how do you do this. And capability-wise, it can be done. You know, Edge Surgical did from Rome to Beijing. They've done some around the world. It's 5,000 kilometers with low latencies, 100 millisecond latencies, so it's doable. And I think there is a genuine push to work out. Now, what the commercial reality of doing that is a different thing. Humanitarian-wise, I get it. Commercially-wise, I struggle a little bit. See it more in China and India, where they've got huge geographies and, you know, they're trying to democratize out.
And less litigious environment.
Yes, exactly. True. So I think there's a place for it. And what I would say is that the Chinese robots are ahead of everyone. A mantra as well, a little bit from India, but they're ahead of everyone on this. You know, the 5G and the... I didn't hear a lot coming out of either Ottava or Medtronic or even Da Vinci on the telesurgery. And maybe Da Vinci's right. Maybe they're just like, this is noise in the pool. Mm-hmm. And you know what? You have at it. You froth up the water there. We'll just continue selling robots and selling systems.
And Dave and Gary have 4 programs going on in-house anyway.
Yeah.
And they're just going to wait until the market declares itself and then just be like...
Done that. Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Let's wrap this up. There's a lot to talk about, but I'd love to just get like quick answers to some of the more interesting players that we've seen. Maybe a bit of a word association game. Sony gave a presentation yesterday. Very cool technology. Big name, obviously. What is your feeling about their moving into the sector? Once you go first, Steve.
Tech demo.
Yeah.
Putting their toe in the water. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Technology's cool. Navigating the FDA, just ask Apple and Google about that.
Yeah. Okay. We've talked a bit about Moon Surgical already, but again, they've had a big splash. They had the truck out front with the champagne and everything. It was very nice. But what's coming up for Moon Surgical?
First introduction to LAP 2.0, and likely, since they're cleared, the next acquisition of a robotic system. My friend Todd Pope will say they're not a robotic system. Todd, love you, buddy. I think they're the next acquisition by somebody in the market over the next 12 to 18 months.
New category. I think they're opening a new category.
Stryker. We haven't talked a lot about Stryker here. Not a lot of hard tissue here. But we talked about neurovascular. Certainly you could see them being a player. What kind of news does Stryker make in surgical robotics in the coming year?
I think Stryker is going to keep their tower systems as the hero. So whatever they do is a tuck-in that keeps their smart ORs and their towers as the hero. That's the way I see that they would approach that. Kevin made it quite clear. We're not going to go and try and smack on the nose intuitive because that's futile.
Yeah.
And he's a smart guy to understand that. So I think it'll be a tuck-in where the Towers still the hero, and potentially ASCs, where they play in their strength, is, you know, an area where they can go and nip around the edges.
Partnership with either Distal or Moon Surgical, if they don't get acquired straight out. I don't think they're going to internalize a surgical robotic program, but I do see that might be the first true partnership in device with an external player.
NVIDIA, we hear about them at every conference now. They're a powerhouse. They're present here, of course. How does their role, I guess, evolve in medtech over the coming years?
Unlocks future potential, not current potential, future potential on that AI model and processing power.
Commercialization and monetization challenges is what comes to my mind. These are all great add-ons, but they're all going to be table stakes. When you put the NVIDIA smarts inside your system, you can't charge more money. It might help you to keep market share or grow some market share a little bit, but there's no direct compensation for that technology that goes in there. It's going to be table stakes. And they're a great partner. You know, they are really rocking it with their systems. And you would be a fool to try and create your own internal one if you can go and get it off the shelf with them.
Great. Let's talk about the big three, at least in my mind, Intuitive. We can't not talk about Intuitive, but tell us something that we haven't talked about Intuitive that you expect to see happen over the next year or so.
Dave made the statement about 2 years ago in a podcast, or Gary, I think, that I'm sorry. We're not a robotic company, we're a surgical company. I think you will see Intuitive move into other interventional and surgical verticals in healthcare.
He certainly said that on the stage at Device Talks West when he was the keynote 2 years ago. So.
As you say, it's not what you say, it's what you do, right? So Apple computers became Apple. Intuitive Surgical became Intuitive. That, for me, said it all right there. That was just a simple thing that said they are not a surgical company anymore. Yeah.
Medtronic and J&J. Well, let's go one at a time. Medtronic. What do we see?
Struggling. Don't know if they have dry powder for an acquisition. Unfortunately, I really like Jeff as a person, as a leader. His team has struggled. You've seen an exodus of high-level C-suite and VPs head out. I think the next 12 to 24 months, they're a very admirable organization and fantastic people in it. I think you see them start to go from number one to number three or four from a gross sales perspective. Wow. Within 5 years.
Mine's quite simple, which is don't make Hugo the hill that you die on.
Yeah.
That's what I'd say. Yeah. Find an alternative as quick as possible. And I think something for them, for example, Mira, okay? That could be a nice diversion away from Hugo at the minute, something like a Mira. I'm not saying Mira's the exact one for them, but they need something else. But don't die on the Hugo hill.
And how about J&J? Steve, why don't you take that one?
Yes, yeah, so J&J, I think that they're at risk that if they delay Ottava anymore and they don't get out and it's not everything that they want it to be, I think it could be the end of their endomechanical business. I think that might be a divestiture in the future.
Joe?
The best large strategic medical device company the world's ever seen. Not the best robotic company. I think right now, with the acquisition of Abiomed and Shockwave, integrating those two companies is going to keep their attention and their resources in order to do it right. I think they may be doubling down on their cardiovascular franchise and maybe backing off on that endo business.
Great. Last one, endovascular robots. Joe, you want to?
VCs line up here.
Yeah.
I think the next 5 to 7 years, you're going to see massive venture money come into endovascular robots.
For me, work out what the right navigation technology is going to be. You can't add more big iron in the room. This is one of the things you can't do. So you've got to be able to navigate these things without adding more footprint in the room, because a lot of this is going to happen in small cath labs. And look for the AI machine learning component for self-navigation. That'll be the things that I would be looking for.
All right. We've covered a lot. We can have a grand conclusion statement. For me, being here has been fantastic. It just has connected so many dots. I look at websites, I look at videos, but to see everything, to see all the robots in one place, to see the doctors talk about the robots and their acceptance of robots, to see the movement in the new space, it's been a real treat to be here. Any conclusions or takeaways or things we haven't talked about?
Look, SRS is all about collaboration. It's very clear when you walk the halls here. People are not hiding. There's no camp set up versus another. It's interesting because the large strategics don't own this category.
Yep.
And so therefore it keeps it an open architecture, which is a good word for surgical robotics,
yep,
for all to be equals. So, you know, no world domination right now. So I think Vip and his team have done a fabulous job. And I think we're probably going to need a larger venue next year.
Yeah, sounds like it. 1,700, I think. Steve?
I think, you know, I've seen the evolution of this meeting almost from the beginning. It used to be an intuitive urology meeting, basically. And what I love is the fact that it's not just surgical anymore. It's all the different interventions. I say there's a load of intervention, a load of new robots here that are in different things that I've just been really thrilled and excited to see. And the fact is, you know, it's different clinical aspects. It's not just surgery. It's really cool. And, you know, it's not dominated by three big players that have the giant biggest booths and everybody else is kind of like, you know, somewhere to put your coffee cup. It's a great meeting for that. And the voice that everyone gets is equal as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's a great meeting.
Fantastic. Well, I appreciate the hour you spent. I've learned a lot. And thanks for I don't know, just caring so much about the industry. It's a lot of fun to follow and read you both. The passion is evident in your posts and in your conversations. And I'm sure people heard it in this conversation. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. One editorial note, we mentioned the podcast, Medtronic's Rajat Kamal, the general manager of the surgical robotics program. He was on stage. He did present. But also there was a pre-recorded interview with Mike Marinaro, who's the executive vice president and president of that group and the surgical group. A couple of the executives there did pre-recorded interviews, included Kevin Lobo of Stryker. So did want to make that note. All right. Well, if you want more of this, if you want to hear more from Steve Bell, join us on Tuesday at Device Talks Tuesdays, Tuesday, July 9th. If you're listening to this after July 9th, you can still watch it on demand. Go to devicetalks.com, register for the July 9th Device Talks Tuesdays. If you're watching it live, you can ask questions of Steve after he gives his presentation, which was really a great presentation at SRS. And it should be a great way to learn a lot. So make sure you do that. And of course, Device Talks West is happening October 16th and 17th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. As I mentioned up top, surgical robotics will be on the table. Interventional will be on the table. Neurotech will be on the table. Structural heart will be on the table. Women's health will be on the table. We'll be talking about a lot of different issues, connected health, and on and on and on. So make sure you go to devicetalks.com, or if you want to go directly to west.devicetalks.com to register. We still have our $200 discount rate right now going on. So save yourself some money and have yourself a couple of great days talking about medtech, remembering why you're part of this industry. All right, folks, that is a wrap. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast.